I'm Brandi Cruz. Today on Undivided, Democrats have spent years denouncing far-right anti-Semitism, but are they now losing the moral high ground? Plus, a major ruling against Attorney General Bob Ferguson and his office, but will voters even care? And the state Democratic Party is now using me to fundraise. Let's hope the fear-mongering doesn't work. That and more coming up today on Undivided. You can support the show for just $5 a month by signing up at UndividedPod.com. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I want to start the Thursday show today by doing something a little different. We always preview or talk about what we're going to discuss on the episode of Sundays with Subscribers that's forthcoming. Usually I do that at the end of the show, but I think it's really timely, the topic that we have coming up, and it's a really important interview. So Reuven Carlisle is a former Democratic state lawmaker in Washington. He's also a Jewish American. And given some of the rhetoric that I think can reasonably be described as anti-Semitic from people on the far left and from some progressives. I thought it would be an interesting conversation on Sunday's show to hear from a Democrat who is also Jewish. And in particular, you know, we talked about, for instance, at the University of Washington, there was the protest that I can't call anything else than pro-Hamas. I mean, you had a protest, and I'll play a clip from it momentarily, but it was the flyer for it had a Hamas paraglider, you know, paragliding in to the concert where innocent people were slaughtered. Here's just a clip of what was said at that protest.
I promise you, Palestine will be free!
So here you have this protest happening at the University of Washington, and it was met, frankly, with meek, if any, condemnation from Democrats in Washington state. You know, we have reached out to Jay Inslee and to Bob Ferguson's offices because they are not only, you know, the current governor and someone who might be the next governor of Washington, but they're also University of Washington alums. And neither of them have spoken out specifically against that kind of hate and vitriol being peddled by student groups on the campus of the University of Washington. So anyway, I wanted to invite on Reuven Carlisle. He actually spoke a few days ago at a vigil for Israel and talked about this sort of false equivalency that has been pushed by, he didn't mention specifically progressives, but I think it's clear who he's talking about.
In our civic society, we have an intellectual embrace of debate, dialogue, and discussion. It is the essence of our identity. There is no debate about rationalizing the moral integrity of this moment. There is no dialogue about justifying this unprovoked war. There is no excuse in discussing moral equivalency.
There is no moral equivalency. There is no justifying it. There is no excusing it. Yet why do so many progressives try to do that? Why have we seen that in Seattle? Why have we seen that from members of Congress, like Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, like Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib? And so I had a conversation again. The full interview will air this week on Sundays with Subscribers with Reuven Carlisle about just that. But you look at Rashida Tlaib, I mean, who's running through the halls of Congress away from a reporter who's asking if she'll condemn the murder of babies, saying nothing.
You can't comment about Hamas terrorists chopping off babies' heads.
You have Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of our state, who has said recently that she believes Israel is a racist state and tried to backpedal it. What do you think your party is to do about that wing of the party?
I think that there's unequivocally a reality, that there is a sense of tension in the far left of the Democratic Party about the role and the reality of Israel today. And that's in many ways a pushback against the Netanyahu government for some. And for some, that's a pure political excuse. They just are deeply opposed to Israel. So that is a reality among some on the far left. I think that anti-Semitism plays a role for some of them, But, you know, as the Jewish people say, it's really about action and not just intent. And I think we're at a time where the action of the United States and the Biden administration, an overwhelming majority of both Democrats and Republicans, has been to support the nation of Israel against this terrorist attack by Hamas. Dealing with the implications is not easy, but the fact that the President of the United States is there today needs to be commended for that moral authority leadership. And I think, as a general rule, the overwhelming majority of Democrats and Republicans strongly support Israel.
Yeah. Do you think that you had mentioned that some of it might be driven by anti-Semitism? Do you believe Congresswoman Jayapal is an anti-Semite?
You know, I don't think she's an anti-Semite. I just think that she has a deep affiliation for the Palestinian community. I think she has a deep affinity and connection to that community. And those are important folks to her and allies and voters and community members. I don't think that at her core that she is anti-Semitic. I do not feel like she is a strong supporter of Israel. And I think she's sort of indicated that by most of her votes. But there are times when she has stepped up when needed in terms of some of the support for Israel. So I think she has complex feelings toward the nation. But of course, I think you have to talk to her directly to really get her sense. But no, I don't believe that she's anti-Semitic.
Well, and I would kind of flip that and say with Trump, you know, because I think it's every party's job to keep their own house in order first before they're pointing fingers at the other party, like, look how bad you are, look how morally bankrupt you are. It's like, get your own house in order and then point fingers across the way. But with Donald Trump, if I were to say, you know, if I were to be asked if he were racist, I think he has a deep affinity for white people. You know, I think he has, they're important for his voting base. And to me, that sounds like a weird defense for her, which is, oh, she has a deep affinity for Palestine. She needs, that's important for her voting base. Is that giving her too much leeway?
Well, I think I would say it a little bit differently. I think that she started her career as a community activist with a number of communities associated with not just Palestinians, but a number of folks in that part of South Seattle. And that's important to her. That's her base. That's her identity. And she cares and connects with communities of color and disproportionately impacted communities very much. And so I just think it's the essence, comes from the essence of her political activism and her career. And so I just think it's core to her base. And I don't, and I just don't think she sees the Jewish community and as part of that. I don't think she includes that in her definition of communities in that way.
So if you want to catch that whole interview, become a subscriber, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. That will air this Sunday on Sundays with Subscribers. I really appreciated what was really a thoughtful conversation and very introspective about, okay, you know, for years and years and years, what have we talked about or heard from the left about Nazis and neo-Nazis and anti-Semitism on the right? And now you see this creeping anti-Semitism on the left. And so what are Democrats going to do about it? What are Democrats going to say about it? It's a really important conversation to have. All right. Bob Ferguson, of course, I've just mentioned him a little bit, could very well be the next governor of Washington State, the current attorney general. This is a story that we've been following for some time, and now it has reached, it appears, its natural conclusion. And it has to do with what I think is a pattern of behavior from Bob Ferguson and his office, which is, first of all, politically motivated legal action by his office that just wastes taxpayer money. He's also had a lot of issues as it pertains to transparency and, you know, public records. But this one has to do with his lawsuit over Value Village. So the, and this is from the Olympian, the headline, Washington Attorney General's office must pay $4.2 million in Value Village lawsuit. The general counsel and chief compliance officer at Value Village said in a statement, we're very pleased with the court's fee award and the judge's ruling confirming the full vindication of our defense in this case. The fee award against the AG's office is the largest in this context in Washington state history. They provide a little bit of background, and I'll get into why this is just so pertinent. It says the situation began in 2017 when AG Bob Ferguson's office alleged that Value Village was deceiving customers, consumers, by presenting itself as a charitable nonprofit organization when in reality it is a for-profit corporation. However, the judge in this case said the AG Strategy's office refused to meet with Value Village or identify which practices needed to be changed during an investigation prior to the state filing a lawsuit, inconsistent with the purpose of the Charitable Solicitations Act. Instead, the state, quote, demanded that Value Village make a multi-million dollar payment to the AG's office to settle the investigation. And when that didn't happen, the AG's office sued the company. So what I think is so interesting here is I have, you know, said of the AG's office for a long time, this goes back to his many, many lawsuits against Donald Trump, where whenever you bring him up and ask him, and I had many interviews with the Attorney General during my time in mainstream media where I asked him that, you know, some people might view these many, many lawsuits against Trump and you bragging about them as politically motivated. And he says, his line is canned. He has the same line every time. Well, they didn't say that when I sued the Obama administration. I mean, you could set your watch to it. That's always his response. And he thinks it's going to deflect that criticism. But he sued the Obama administration just a couple times over very obscure things, and he never made such a big deal about it as he has and had with the Trump lawsuits, where he's on national news. It's basically his whole political persona is, I've sued Trump this many times, and here's my winning record. And so I'm concerned about, you know, this office, which really should be a nonpartisan office. You shouldn't be concerned about political prosecutions from the Attorney General's office. You shouldn't be concerned about frivolous prosecutions where they're going after someone and it ends up just costing us millions and millions of dollars. I mean, in this case, as the judge found, we have a Charitable Solicitations Act. And yes, there are rules if someone identifies as a nonprofit or a charity. But one of the first things that it asks the government to do, and it's so reasonable, is to go to whatever organization it is that you think is not following the Charitable Solicitations Act and telling them, hey, we think you're running afoul of this. Here's some things you can do to come into compliance. And then they can fix it and everyone can move on, or they don't fix it. And then, yeah, you proceed with something. But what this judge found and why this is such a massive settlement against the Attorney General's office, and I hate headlines like this where it says, "Why Attorney General's office must pay $4.2 million. No, the taxpayers are going to pay $4.2 million. Where do you think they get that money from? But this could have been so easy for Bob Ferguson's office to say, hey, you need to make some changes or you're going to be in hot water. They didn't do that, though. They demanded some sort of multi-million dollar payment. And when Value Village is like, what? No, they sued him. And this has been a 6-year-long ordeal. 6 years. And so you can imagine how many resources of the office went into this, only for taxpayers to be on the hook for millions of dollars and for Value Village to emerge justified. And throughout all of that, Bob Ferguson was using this to make headlines for himself. Oh, we're going after Value Village. And he always does. Oh, we're sticking up for the people of Washington State. The only thing you did is stick it to the people of Washington State. You stuck us with a big bill because of your political ambitions. So he's really used this office and the power of his office to further his political star. I'm glad that there continues to be, I think, an increasing amount of critical coverage of Bob Ferguson from mainstream newspapers. You know, there has been some newspapers who have exposed some of his, like there was a lawsuit involving the Department of Health and Human Services or Social and Health Services where his office withheld all of these records. They got a big fine over that. So I think it's important because it speaks to who he'd be as governor, right? Why would he, as Attorney General, be someone whose office just blatantly hides public records, has no care or concern for transparency, uses his office to further his political ambitions? Why would he all of a sudden become governor and change? He's not going to. That's who he is. And that's what he's going to use the governor's office for. And that's what these sort of things point to. So $4.2 million, pay up, everyone, the price of having Bob Ferguson as our attorney general. All right, coming up next in our segment, Unbelievable, the latest chapter in my feud with the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. She thinks it's a feud. I just have some legitimate questions, of course. But first, are you thinking about putting your home on the market? I'm sure if you are, you have a lot of questions right now. It's kind of a weird market. It's up and down. You don't know who to believe about whether it's a good time to sell your home. So I recommend reaching out to our friend Wes Jones. He's been a real estate agent in the greater King County area for some time. And he can help make sure that you list your home at the right time and that when you list it, it is ready to go. So the listing really shines in the way that it should. We asked him about what his first steps would be if someone decides to sell their home with him.
Oh, I think the first step is having an idea of maybe what your home is worth, you know, and having that kind of baseline home value. And that's something that we can do complimentary. You can go to the website, sellwithwest.com. You just plug in your address and we'll get you a value range. And if you want, and if you're serious, you know, I'll come out and do a quick, you know, market analysis for you. That's all complimentary. And then at that time or another time, we could walk through the basic steps of what it would take to get your home ready for the market.
Yeah, and I think that's important, is having somebody walk you through it, and then also having somebody who knows what it takes to get attention to a listing, what it takes from a marketing perspective, what it takes from maybe work that needs to be done to a home. So fine, check out a few real estate agents. Make sure one of them is our friend Wes Jones. Visit sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party is hopeless. Hopeless, I say. Let's get to it in our segment, Unbelievable. All right, I have detailed at length my Twitter beef with the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, but it's really more than that. I have used this as an example of how the left in particular in Washington State tries to shut down any legitimate debate, disagreement, and argument by name calling and labeling. And they just hope that if they do that, then you'll get scared and you'll shut up. And I don't want you to shut up. I want you to push back. And so I want to be an example of what that looks like. And so just in case you guys weren't following the show earlier this week, the new chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, Shasti Conrad, she had come under criticism for sending out a tweet saying she wanted to get Democratic supermajorities in the state legislature in 2026 so she could, quote, clean up the state constitution. I don't want anybody cleaning up the state constitution. And I also don't like the idea of someone so power hungry, they want to consolidate power to such an extent that they can make changes to the constitution on the whims of a single political party. I just don't think that's particularly helpful. So I had done a segment criticizing that statement from her, in part because for a couple reasons. Her response to any criticism of the statement was, oh, far-right crazy people will criticize us. That's what they do. And I'm like, okay, you know, you can name call, but I think it's legitimate to be concerned about one party consolidating that much power. And she also was, in her Twitter comments, just sort of changing the reason she said she wanted to clean up the Constitution. At first, it was about voting rights, and then she was talking about abortion. So either she just really doesn't know what she wants to clean up, or she was just trying to figure out, okay, I sent this crazy tweet, so let me say it's about abortion, which is, you know, in Washington State, most people are pro-choice, I would argue. And so she's like, that'll be politically popular, and people won't push back. But anyway, so I sent out this not only segment criticizing what she said and pointing to the dangers of it, but I also... she had responded to me saying, oh, Brandy's a far right hater. This is what haters do. And I'm like, okay, list one thing, one policy position I hold that's far right. Just one. Give me one concrete policy position you believe I hold that's far right. And crickets from Shasti Conrad. And I asked her that not so much because I believe there's actually a policy position I hold that's far right, but because I want to know what her definition of far right is. And that would actually expose her far more than it would expose me, because I'm assuming she's going to say something that really isn't far right at all. But anyway, so after I had asked her, name one freaking thing I support that's far right, what did she do? Nicole, did you even count? It's like a 30-part tweet. Many, many parts to this tweet.
Oh yeah, lots of parts.
So Shasti Conrad is now using me to fundraise for the Washington State Democratic Party. So she is now claiming that she's under attack as a brown woman by far right wingers on the internet. And because of that, you should give the state Democratic Party money. It's all just very sad. So let's go through just, I cannot read you the whole thread. It's just too much. It's too much. So let's just go through a little bit of it. So she said, she started it with, and this tells you all you need to know. Hi, Shasti Conrad here. I'm the first Asian American woman to chair a major state party in the contiguous USA. I'm currently being attacked by the far right in Washington for championing democratic values. Make their attacks backfire. Chip in and support the Washington State Democratic Party. Oh, this is sad. I gotta feel bad for her. So first of all, I love that she leads with identitarianism, of course. Like, I'm the first Asian American woman to chair a major state party, and I'm currently being attacked by the far right. Okay, so you're making it sound like people are attacking you because of the color of your skin, which is absurd, of course, because I've articulated why I was legitimately criticizing her over something she said. But of course, that's the easy thing to do. Play victim. Oh, I'm being attacked because of the color of my skin. Super lazy. And just kind of low IQ, if I'm being honest. Oh, now she's going to say I called her low IQ on a show called Undivided because of the color of her skin. And she says she's being attacked by the far right in Washington for championing democratic values. First of all, Washington really doesn't have a far right. There's a couple, but I'm certainly not on the far right. So again, she's just lying, and she's trying to get money out of it. So then she goes on, it's this whole long thread. And then she says, of course, the far right will hate and fearmonger. Just look at some of the hateful messages that have come my way since right-wing commentator Brandi Cruz posted a video about my tweet a few days ago. And then she posts some of it, which isn't very bad or interesting, and some of it is like no-name people on Twitter being hateful. I refuse to absorb responsibility for everything someone tweets at you, Shasti Conrad. You're the chair of the state Democratic Party. You are a public figure, and this is a common tactic. I've seen it used by Seattle City Council members. I've seen it used by far-left bloggers, where they're like, oh, I said something dumb, and I said something worthy of criticism, and there was legitimate pushback, and so now I'm like, oh, people are attacking me. Feel bad for me. I'm the victim. No, I don't think anybody should ever resort to personal, hateful messages. Although I did just call her low IQ. Maybe I should rethink that. Okay. I didn't call her low IQ. I said it's a low IQ way of debating.
Exactly.
Which it is a low IQ way of debating. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm not going to, this doesn't work on me. This shouldn't work on anybody. It's like, oh, we better back off because she says she's being attacked for the color of her skin. And she says that people are being mean to her on the Twitters now. So no, that's ridiculous. It's the laziest of lazy. And then she goes on to say of me, and then she likes to pretend she isn't far right. Girl, come on. Not to mention that she has hate mongers like Andy Ngo cheering her on, thinking she'll disavow. Personally, I'm not holding my breath. So she pulls up a tweet Andy Ngo sent to me in November of 2021. Andy Ngo covers Antifa. He's an independent journalist. And he's in thanking me for my incredible journalism. So she had to, what, dig back into the 2021 as a way to paint me as far right to find a reply that Andy Ngo sent to one of my tweets in 2021. This is getting sad. This is interesting. Let's keep going, shall we? She goes on to say, commentators like Brandi Cruz serve one purpose, to sanitize and mainstream right-wing culture wars and grievance politics. That's why she made a whole video about a tweet of mine where I talk about the very good and democratic process of amending our state constitution. That's not what you said at all. You said, I want a supermajority in 2026 so I can clean up our state constitution. It was like one sentence. Nowhere in it did you offer a, quote, very good and democratic process of amending our state constitution. You didn't mention that at all. And then she goes, which to note has already been amended 108 times, but it's somehow a problem when I talk about doing it. No, it's a problem when you talk about doing it via supermajority. So doing it without any bipartisan support whatsoever. Yeah, you can amend the state constitution. You don't have to have supermajorities to do it. You have to have bipartisan agreement that there's something in the constitution that exists that needs to be amended because either it's out of date or it's out of touch with where Washington state is. But you specifically want to make sure that Democrats can, quote, clean it up without any sort of ability of anyone else to dissent or push back. That's the difference. I'm sure you realize that, or maybe you don't, but it's incredibly disingenuous for you to say, well, it's already been amended 108 times. Yeah, you want to amend it without anybody dissenting. And then she says, Brandi Cruz was trying to make a scandal out of my having policy positions about two issues that Democrats really care about, democracy and abortion, the horror. I know it's October spooky season, but this is too much. No, I'm not trying to make a scandal out of you having policy positions. That's your job. You're the chair of the state Democratic Party. I am talking specifically about your desire. Again, I don't know how many times I have to say it, about your desire to consolidate power so much so that you have supermajorities and can change anything that Democrats want about the state constitution. Like, I know that Democrats have certain policy preferences when it comes to voting access. I know that Democrats have certain policy preferences when it comes to abortion, which, by the way, Shasti Conrad, I'm sure you and I have the same view of abortion. I'm pro-choice up to fetal viability, unless, of course, you're pro-choice beyond fetal viability, which, why don't you say so? And we can have a conversation about that, because that would be a very extreme position. And then she says, anyway, As a brown woman in politics, I love this woman with her identity politics. Anyway, as a brown woman in politics, I've come to expect this sort of nonsense, but I don't accept it. If you're sick and tired of this type of right-wing divisiveness, will you make a donation to Washington Democrats today? Can I use this to my own? If you're sick and tired of this kind of divisiveness from the state Democratic Party, become a subscriber to the Undivided Podcast for just $5 a month today at undividedpod.com. Can I use it in the same way? I'm going to put together a whole 15-tweet thread about how I'm being discriminated against because I'm white and the left, far left fringe is attacking me. Look at the mean things they've said to me on Twitter. So become a subscriber of my podcast for just $5 a month. And then, of course, it wouldn't be a left-wing thread from Shasti Conrad without using the her favorite four-letter word, MAGA. With the rise of MAGA extremism in the United States, we have a moral responsibility to secure states like Oregon, California, and Washington as a strong blue wall in the West. Hold on a second. So first of all, I don't know if she's trying to tie me into MAGA. She probably doesn't know that I don't particularly like Donald Trump because she obviously doesn't watch the show. However, you're saying that you haven't secured states like Oregon, California, and Washington? There isn't one elected Republican in statewide office in any of those states. You have had a Democratic trifecta in Washington state for the last 8 years and 14 of the last 20 legislative sessions. You've had a governor in the governor's mansion for 40 years. What about that isn't a strong blue wall in the West? No, you are power hungry. You need more. You need a super majority so there's no room for anyone to disagree with your ideas. And again, this is someone who, may I remind you, when she calls me or any other reasonable people far right or right wing, keep in mind, she is further to the left than probably 99% of Washington voters. She supported a candidate who was so morally bankrupt, so deeply flawed, that even progressive Seattleites were like, oh, that woman's crazy. But no, Shasti Conrad supported Nicole Thomas Kennedy, who told police officers to go eat some COVID-laced SHIT who celebrated arson, and she supported her because she is also that fringe. So, I mean, she can call reasonable, moderate Washingtonians far right or MAGA or whatever she wants, but truly she is outside the mainstream, even in a progressive blue state. And I'll just point out that she is so identity obsessed that in her Twitter bio, which you get just like one line to explain who you are and what you're all about, her line is, first woman of color chair for Washington Dems, former Obama and Bernie staffer, former chair of KC Dems, first woman of color chair. Is that what you live and breathe by? That some characteristic you can't even change, that you had no say in, that you were born with, is what absolutely, like, what qualifies you for the job, identifies who you are and everything that you are on this planet? It's very, very strange stuff. Very strange stuff indeed. Unbelievable, as we would say. Okay, I want to follow up to a story we first discussed this week, and that is King County Executive Dow Constantine saying that the county is in a dire, how do you put it? Here's the article from Como News. King County warns of dramatic fiscal situation if cap on property taxes doesn't change. And essentially what he is saying is that in Washington state, there is a cap that voters put in place in 2001, a cap on property tax increases year to year. So it used to be 6%. Voters in 2001 said, no, you're not going to increase our property taxes 6% every year. So they capped it at 1%. And now Dow Constantine is saying, well, that cap is putting us in a dire fiscal situation, despite the fact he just came out and said they want to spend $1 billion on climate, and they're spending hundreds or tens of millions of dollars on climate justice initiatives, despite the fact he just came out and launched a regional office to combat quote-unquote gun violence, which his plan to combat gun violence isn't going to do anything. So they waste billions of dollars. But this is just about wanting more money. This is just about him not liking that voters are the ones who 21 years ago decided we want to cap our property taxes, and they just want more money so they can put it towards their equity initiatives or whatever it is. So anyway, I want to ask on the show today, King County Councilman Reagan Dunn, because he's truly trying to fight back against this on an island, because he recognizes what a lot of common sense, rational people in King County recognize, and that is that the government needs to do more with the money it already has. Back to Undivided.
Thanks for having me on, Brandy.
So Dow Constantine says that your fiscal situation in the county is dramatic. Do you agree?
Oh, not really. That sounds like another pitch to just raise taxes again. I think that there has been a lot of interesting money flowing from the federal government to the county government in the last couple of budget cycles that has helped county government get its mission accomplished. But in doing so, that money has been spread around to all kinds of different groups and community organizations in somewhat irresponsible fashion. And now that that COVID money is drying up, the county, certain leaders are starting to scream bloody murder. But if you do a deeper dive, what you'll realize is the county has spent and created more new tax revenue streams over the last decade and hasn't taken care of the one revenue stream that really matters, and that is our general fund. That's the fund that supports the prosecutor, the sheriff, the courts, the jail systems. That's where they're complaining, because not right now, but in the next biennium, there's supposed to be a $100 million shortfall unless there is some reordering and reprioritization of government.
Yeah. So Dow Constantine is basically saying this is an Olympia problem. Lawmakers in Olympia need to remove the 1% property tax increase cap in order for them to collect more money. Is there anything to that?
You know, they call that the structural budget gap. That's just budget speak. But of course, the voters passed the 1% budget. They don't want all these new tax increases. That's the truth across the state. Seattle seems to vote for every tax increase they can, tax happy. And they've raised taxes in a lot of different areas, but not, again, to support this. Look, you could easily solve this problem through a reprioritization of existing resources. You could roll down those massive environmental programs, the various, pork projects and special interest funding that exists, and then reallocate that same money to the general fund, and you would have a revenue neutral option for the county to consider. That never seems to be done. It could be put on the ballot. It would solve the problem, forcing the county to live within its means, which it hasn't really done over the last decade or two.
If King County voters, and I know that this would have to be a statewide vote, but one of the questions I had is, okay, if Democrats in Olympia, because they continue to try to lift that 1% that was capped by voters in 2001, if they were to say, okay, let's go back to the people, let's see if the people want to change their minds. Do you think that would pass in King County to remove it?
It'd be close. Maybe it would pass in King County, but of course, statewide, it wouldn't. I don't think it would pass again, particularly now. You know, you have this, well, Washington State has the highest gas prices in the country. Down at Texas this weekend, I got gas for $2.48 a gallon, $2.84 a gallon, to be accurate. It's ridiculous. $18 tolls are being proposed now there by WashDOT. This intent to get revenue at every turn. People are tired of it. You see this massive increase in inflation, the cost of living, the cost of rent, housing, some of those environmental programs that have seized up all the land are now creating shortages in buildable land. There are a lot of problems there. And so I think people are tired of spending more money. This is not a good time to raise taxes. This is not a good time to that same old downtown Seattle mantra that we got to get rid of this 1% stuff. Here's an idea. Prioritize government. Live within your means. Keep taxes flat. If you're going to, you need to increase in a certain area, decrease in another area. There's like 30 different revenue streams you can do that from. Nobody seems willing to do that because nobody politically wants their ox to be gored in some constituency, wherever it is, whether it's an environmental program or the inner city or some other area. So that's some of the challenges we face. And the only way that those tough decisions get made is if the voters push back.
Yeah, well, because you're outnumbered, obviously, on the council. And then for Democrats who have been trying to lift that property tax increase limit for so long, and now they've got the executive, the largest county, the most populated county, the county that brings in the most revenue to the state, saying, hey, do this or else we're in a dire fiscal situation. Do you feel like it's just sort of a foregone conclusion that Democrats are going to do that in Olympia?
It's just sort of known. If you're in an elected office, you know that the Democrats' goal is to raise taxes wherever they can get away with it. It's just that simple. That's what you get rewarded for by big labor. That's what you get rewarded for by special interest and within your own party organization. So the trick is to find ways to push back thoughtfully against that in a lot of different ways. And that's what you got to do. Otherwise, you know, those seniors on fixed incomes will continue to have less and less to get by with at a time when there are really no options out there for them. And it really is something that is important. But I think polling, interestingly, even in King County, Washington State's pretty fiscally conservative when you think about it. And that's what we've got going for us. There's going to be some public employees that are going to have to, you know, get laid off. There won't be the intense hiring sprees that the county's gone through the last couple of years. So it's going to be tough. It won't be easy, but that's the important process. Just like people do in their households, we need to do it at county government.
And let me just ask you, it's technically unrelated, but I don't really think it is, because you're talking about, hey, be a good steward of the money that you already have coming in and of these revenue streams. And you've been pushing for a closer look at some of these, I guess, social justice programs, criminal justice programs that got money from taxpayers. And there's been some evidence that that money was not spent well and was mishandled. Have you gotten any interest at the state level or the county level for these audits?
I think there's a lot of interest in the, you know, within the citizenry, the taxpayer has interest. Obviously, I'm not going to get very far at King County. I did send that letter to our state auditor, Pat McCarthy. She said basically no, to make a long story short. I think that's too bad. I mean, these restorative community pathways aren't they're not measured. They have a tiny percentage of young people who show up to that diversion program and complete it. We've had just some really crazy, there's been some embezzlement related to that program. There's been, there was a gun battle between two participants. I mean, it's not going well. Diversion programs are important for our youth, but I think these will be, you know, exhibit A, B, and C on what not to do from a county government. Unfortunately, of this game, and ultimately the end is going to be, obviously, it'll be huge examples of mistrust and misplacement of funds in this. And until somebody does an audit, we may not know until the press blows it up because some piece of information gets leaked out there. I'd rather have it fixed early. I'd rather have an audit be done, find out where the mistakes are, and recorrect the program so they're working the way that the county intends them to work. Because right now they don't seem to be effective at all.
Yeah, I know you're on tight timeline. Let me just ask you, why do you think there's such a hesitancy to audit a program that has had such obvious and public failings when it came to their management of funds?
Because it's in the majority party's power base, right? These are the communities and really recommended programs in the Democratic Party, and they don't want to touch them. They don't want to be the ones to say, no, this is ridiculous, until they're forced to do so. And so, you know, I'm giving them cover by being the one person calling for an audit, an independent audit through accounting standards. Just look at it. How's it doing? And maybe the county auditor, whom I reached out to as well, will be willing to take this on. I think it makes sense. And even these nonprofit groups need to know, ultimately, they also need to be accountable for the taxpayer dollars being spent on their programs too.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, if the goal is to have these programs be successful and have good outcomes, then yeah, you should want to know that the money is being used to that end. So King County Councilman Reagan Dunn, just trying to fight the good fight on an island. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brandy. Always good to see you.
So we appreciate Reagan Dunn coming on with us. And I think that last topic we discussed is an important one, too, is like, you can't even, first of all, the money you already have, you're not even willing to give it proper oversight. So that doesn't instill a lot of trust that this money, if the property tax cap is lifted, that the money is going to be spent to good effect. I mean, we already kind of know it's not, right? Because that's just their pattern of practice. But also, I think in reference to the new regional office on gun violence, okay, chances are pretty high you're going to give a lot of money through that office to some of these social justice initiatives and organizations when you already have a really bad track record of giving that money to groups that have shown no accountability for it. So I am fully in agreement with Reagan Dunn that you've got to show that you're capable of actually using the money you already have in a responsible way and not consistently at every turn finding different ways to try to get the state legislature to give you ways to get more money or to try to go to the people to get more money from them. And I feel so bad for the population of King County that's like east of Issaquah, because they don't want any of this stuff. And they're stuck with it. Like I said, they're planning on going to voters next year to get $1 billion for a climate justice or something. Oh my God, can you imagine being east of Issaquah? Like, you gotta be kidding me. And then Seattle voters get to dictate all of that for you. Oh, soul sucking. Okay, FirstMark Insurance, firstmarkinsurance.com. Mike and I are members of the FirstMark family. Here's the deal. Take the FirstMark challenge. It doesn't cost you anything. And in fact, it could save you money, which we know right now is a pretty good thing. And unfortunately, it's very necessary for a lot of families. Mike and I took the FirstMark challenge. We knew we were kind of underinsured as we were merging our lives together. And after the FirstMark challenge, we ended up getting much better insurance, much more insurance for the same price. And so now all of our insurance, our homeowners insurance, our vehicles, our life insurance, FirstMark handles it all. We asked Dave Taylor, the CEO of FirstMark, who their ideal client is.
Our client is anybody that values advice and wants to have a partner in their insurance buying decision and in helping them manage those accounts moving forward. So it can be as simple as someone that owns a car and rents an apartment to the uber wealthy that have assets all across the world that we need to insure. So we really, what's most important for us is somebody that values this partnership and wants to have us guide them through it.
Yeah, and honestly, I think everyone can use advice on that. Insurance is confusing. I don't think I ever fully understood my insurance coverage until I did the FirstMark challenge. And so if anything, you're going to get a lot of useful information out of it. So FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. They work for you. Yes, you. You. Nicole's giving me funny looks over there. Hey, I'm into it, okay?
Yeah, you're very silly today.
Hey, silly?
Yeah.
I'm just having a good time.
Yesterday you were on fire. Today you're silly.
So I'm not on fire today.
No, it's just that it's not diff. I mean, it's just a different.
Are you
different
calling me unserious?
Description.
I'm having a good time and I'm also making a difference.
It's good. It's balanced.
Okay, good. Gotcha. I can get angry if you want me to get angry.
No, please don't.
Don't test me.
I'll let you know. Save it.
Okay,
save
great. It. All right. Dipping outside of Washington State. We have an insurrection on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. I can't be with all seriousness. No, but you probably saw the video. There was quite a significant, I would call it pro-Palestine, but also like pro-Hamas, basically, rally inside the Capitol Rotunda, which, man, I thought you couldn't go in there en masse to protest the government. The headline, Hamas sympathizers storm Capitol office building, draw GOP criticism, insurrection on Capitol Hill, they called it. I also saw some Republicans, and to be fair, some Democrats spoke out against it too, but more so with the content of their words than them actually being in Capitol protesting. Here's a little clip of some of what went down. I love this guy getting thrown to the ground. He was kind of laughing and then he's like, oh, this is serious. Yeah, and at some point, I think Rashida Tlaib spoke to the crowd as well. And so it was a pretty significant protest inside the Capitol. And there was a lot of police there, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, here's the thing. When I see Republicans, so first of all, it is a very American thing to protest. I have approximately zero interest in criticizing people who want to protest, or zero problem with criticizing people who want to protest at our nation's capital. I think that's a very American exercise. And do I particularly like the message of these protesters? No. Did I like the message of the January 6th protesters who I'll separate from the rioters? No. But I don't really have a problem with someone physically being inside the nation's capital protesting. Now, I do have a problem when any protester breaks the law, which I think makes them a rioter. So for individuals who committed crimes on January 6th, for individuals who broke the law during this particular protest, yeah, arrest them, send them to jail. I find it interesting, though, the sort of moral hypocrisy of, for instance, Republicans who are like, insurrection, you know, and Marjorie Taylor Greene was like, we need to throw the book at them because they're looking at what happened to January 6th people who got in trouble for the simple act of being inside the Capitol. And they're like, treat them fairly. When I would have rather seen those Republicans defend these protesters, that's what I would have rather seen, because I would have rather them come out and taken the moral high ground in a morally consistent position and said, hey, we had people on January 6th who went through this long legal process, some of which ended up with lengthy prison sentences. And I'll acknowledge some of those people actually like hurt other individuals and broke the law. But for people who were just there, they should have said, no, they have every right to be there. And no, of course, we shouldn't throw the book at them unless they're breaking the law, because then that's a morally consistent position. Nicole, it looks like you have something to say to me.
Well, no, I was just going to say that guy was getting tackled by Capitol Police.
Yeah.
Capitol Police were obviously being harassed to some extent. I mean, one of them was getting pushed around and whatever.
And that's
wrong. So right. I get that they're you know, speaking out against those people, and they're mixed in with all of these people, right? So if I think as a protest, you have to be that organized. And I think that there's some that think that they're encouraging that kind of behavior.
Yeah, but you can't in any protest. I've always said, so that I've said
you
this
in
Seattle.
You can't control everybody.
You can't control everybody. And in Seattle, for instance, during May Days, for years and years and years, there would be sometimes 10,000 peaceful marchers in the March for Worker and Immigrant Rights. And then there'd be like 10 Antifa causing trouble.
Right.
So you really expect 10,000 people to go away while police try to deal with 10 Antifa? No. But, you know, you are responsible for what happens within your own ranks. But I think that you ought to be able to protest inside our nation's capital, because that's the people's house, as long as you're not being violent or destructive. And so that's where the lines kind of get blurred. And where I think they did get blurred on January 6th is there's definitely some people who deserved prison time over January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've taken issue with 20-year prison sentences compared to lenient prison sentences for murder suspects.
Right.
Doesn't make a lot of sense. But also, I don't think the simple act of protesting against the government, your government, inside the Capitol building is a crime. And I just would have liked to see, I think Republicans could have used this as an opportunity to like flip it on its head a little bit.
Well, who knows? They might have. It didn't get a lot of coverage. There's
You keep saying that. It did.
It got some, but it did not get a lot. There's a lot going on right now. I don't think that it got nearly what it would have had it been a different kind of protest, right?
100%.
And
yes, and this is what we're talking about on the Sunday show with Reuben Carlisle, is one of the things I brought up to him is if these were right-wing neo-Nazis on the University of Washington campus spewing anti-Semitic nonsense, do you think, really think, that the governor and the attorney general would have said nothing?
I mean, these could have been...
Of course not.
No, yeah. There's so many things that they have commented on. I have a little bit of issue with some of their lack of, or no, I have a lot of issues with their lack of voice or having an opinion or lack of statements regarding things like that, because it's very one-sided. They speak out against the side they don't.
Right.
They don't like.
Yeah,
the rest of the time, they're pretty quiet if it's uncomfortable. And then when it is going to score them some points, then they're very vocal.
Oh, 100%. But to your point, if this were right-wingers inside the Capitol again, like let's say it was right-wingers or Trump supporters who were protesting against U.S. aid to Ukraine.
Right.
In the Capitol, in those big of numbers.
Perfect example.
That would have been quite an ordeal.
Yes.
And it would have gotten much more media attention. I don't disagree. And I guess I can't blame some Republicans for being like, hey, isn't that an insurrection? I thought that was an insurrection. But I also think, like, let's have a morally consistent stand. And what kind of behavior in protest is acceptable within our nation's capital, and what is not? I tend to look at just individual actual criminal acts. It should be treated the same, no matter who it is, no matter what cause they're there for. And it did look like some people got arrested. So,
But again, if you were pictured inside the Capitol last time, you lost your job, you were alienated when you got home, it was, you were the devil.
Yes.
And this, not so much.
Not so much. It's just interesting. It's just interesting how this all works.
It's very interesting.
No, it's not. We already know how it all works. We've been talking about it for a long time. Okay, before we get to questions and comments from the live stream, which will be a little different today, Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, I've been talking about my fantastic results on the program just over a year's time. I mean, the pictures are absolutely night and day. I lost 37 pounds total, feeling wonderful. So glad I did that for myself. And I started this time last year, and you might be like, I'm not going to start right now. Thanksgiving's coming up, Halloween candy. And all this, it's like, okay, it's 60 days out of your life. And just look at like the transformation that I had. And at some point, it's never a good time to start a new journey, a new weight loss journey. But you just got to decide, hey, I want to do this for myself. And that's what I did, because I'd gained so much weight during the pandemic. So if you're interested in trying out the program, or at least asking some questions about it, schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team at Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. com. All right. No questions and comments from the live stream today, because I'll just be frank, this is a pre-taped show today. You know why? It's Thursday, and instead of having my sister on for Florida Report as we speak, I'm in Florida chatting with my sister who got out of the hospital this week. And so I flew out late last night on a red eye, and I'm going to help my sister for just a couple days do some physical therapy. I think I mentioned on the show the other day, she has a little issue with her use of her arms and legs. It's getting better by the day, but that just, I guess, is a natural result of being on paralytics while she was intubated for 7-8 days. So yeah, we're going to do some old lady. Nicole, you'll appreciate this, because you do old lady pool exercises. What do you call it? Pool aerobics?
Yeah, water aerobics.
Water aerobics. Mm-hmm. Now we wonder why Nicole's single.
I do the night classes. There's some 40s in there.
Sure there are, Nicole. I do some water exercises with Miranda, help her get back to normal.
It's good for you.
Well, I would do it if nobody could see me do it.
Which workout class do you take twice a week?
First of all, that's just mean. None. I don't take one. That's why should
hey,
do that?
You were being mean to
that's
me.
Very nice. No, I was joking around. That hurt. I'm just kidding. So yeah, so we decided to pre-tape the show so I could get one sneak one extra day in with Miranda.
Yeah, I'm excited to get to see her awake.
Oh my gosh,
person.
It's quite a long trip over there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I left last time, she was still on the breathing machine, and so I'm excited to go and give her a big hug.
Yeah.
Probably stroke her hair for a while.
They're all comfy at home.
Yeah. And I also I'm going to get to witness her reunion with her dog. Okay. So she has not yet seen her dog. And I mean, you know how I am with my dogs. And her dog is obsessed. So when I was there, when she was on the breathing machine, I did go to her house and saw her dog. And I think it had already been like 4 or 5 days that he hadn't seen her. And so he was, I think I was like Miranda enough for him.
Yeah,
he lost it, and he's licking and just. And so I can't even imagine how. I'll try to videotape it. Like if I,
because
I'm pretty sure that I'm going to get to witness it. So I'll have to videotape her dog, Henny, reuniting with his mom. It's going to be great.
That's
so
very cool.
Appreciate you guys giving me the latitude to be able to kind of come and go these last few weeks and stuff. Yeah. So no questions and comments, although I'm sure I'll read them back. And I'm sure, as usual, they are genius. And if there's any super chats that came through, Nicole will save them.
Yep.
And then I'll read them on Monday's show. You have my word. All right. Let's see here. We've been chatting every week on Thursday with our friend Zach Abraham over at Bulwark Capital, turning all of us into financial whizzes and managing our risk. I've already whizzes. Every time I say it, am I 12? 12 years old. Turning us into financial experts and helping us manage our risk in today's uncertain economy. A couple weeks ago, Zach Abraham and I talked about, he's the head of Bulwark Capital Management, knowyourriskradio.com. Zach and I talked about Bidenomics and the fact that it's just a house of cards. It's built on all this printed money. And at some point, common sense tells us it's going to come crashing down. And so I asked Zach to explain, you know, from his position, what kind of indicators they look for to know when that fall might happen. Zach Abraham, welcome back to Undivided.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Yeah, well, just because the world is crazy right now, I thought it'd be good to follow up on a previous conversation we had about Bidenomics, and it's a house of cards, and at some point it's going to come crashing down. As an expert on finance, what clues do you look for? Is there a way to sort of read the tea leaves as to when that might happen?
You know, there are several different things coming up next year, and I think that right now is a decidedly tough time to do that. And the reason why I say that is you're coming off the longest and biggest bull market in U.S. history. And I think it's hard to argue with, but I think that you can make several arguments for this being the greatest financial bubble in human history. And there's just a lot of stuff out there that is trading it at nonsensical stuff because people are, or nonsensical prices because people are still living in the COVID mania idea that because a stock was $800, you know, a year and a half ago, and now it's trading at 50, that it's got to get back to 800 when you're looking at them going, that stock's a flaming pile of, you know, whatever. So that part of it's tough to know on the stock side because stocks are detached from reality. I mean, you're watching, you know, you look at Apple reached an all-time high valuation price this year on the back of 3 consecutive quarters of declining earnings, revenue, and margins. First time that's happened in 15 years. And that's when investors push it to the highest valuation in history. So, you know, it's almost like if you start losing money, that makes your company more profitable. So that part of it, right, makes it a little tougher, because right now investors don't care about underlying value. They just don't. I think they will soon. But next year is going to be a really big issue, because next year you're going to be completely run down of the excess savings that were built up going through COVID, right? That's really what's keeping the economy afloat right now. It's credit issuance is falling off a cliff, all of these things. People are still spending down their stimmy money. And there's still a little bit of that left. That's almost exhausted. But next year is going to be really interesting, because you have a deluge of commercial office space coming up for refinancing. If rates are anywhere near here, you're going to see 60 to 70% write downs on the principal value of a lot of those buildings. And you're also looking at a glut of corporate refinances that are coming up, which means corporations are going to have to refinance their existing debt, which, mind you, U.S. corporations have never been in anywhere near as much debt as they are now. And just think what happens to a corporate earnings when, you know, they've got a $10 billion pile of debt and they're forced to refinance it next year at 9.5% as opposed to the 3.5% that they've carried it at over the last, you know, 10 years. So I think it could very well be hitting the fan right now. Certainly you get into next year with rates the way they're at. I mean, we don't understand how you can possibly avoid recession with all these headwinds.
So you specialize in risk management. For the regular working class person, should they always be in a posture of risk management, or should they only be in a posture of risk management when there is something tangible on the horizon?
Yeah, so great question. Obviously, I think the closer you are to retirement, the more imperative a risk management strategy is. Bottom line, you just have less time to adjust, right? Or you have less time to recover from any real losses. But you know, it goes back to the old Warren Buffett adage of the first 3 rules of managing money are don't lose money. And then rules 2 and 3 are see rule number 1, right? So don't lose money. And it just has to do, Brandy, with the way math works. And most people don't realize this. We use an analogy with our clients. If you look at the stock market from 2000 to today, if you just invested in the stock market, you averaged about 7.5% returns. Okay, over the same period of time from 2000 to today, if you were in a portfolio that never made more than 75% of the market to the upside, so market's up 10, you're up 7.5, and you also subsequently never took on more than 25% of the downside, right? So you never did better than 75% of the market, but you never lost more than 25% of the market in down years. Over that same period of time, instead of 7.5% per year returns, you end up with 14.5% returns. So if you want better returns over time, which I think is what we all want, right? Limiting losses in down years is actually more important than maximizing profits in up years. And it's just the math.
Yeah. Well, that's good advice. Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital, knowyourriskradio.com. We appreciate having you as always.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it as well.
If you're interested in mitigating your risk, maybe you're just starting to save for retirement, or you're getting pretty close to retirement, or you're already there, visit knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. Reach out to Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital Management. This is what they do best, manage risk, and we are certainly in a risky environment. All right, let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? We've been talking a lot about just indicators that things in Washington state have gone way too far, that we have to reel it back in. We need a break. We need someone to come in. I don't care if it's Dave Reichert, or maybe Republicans can win back the House or the Senate. Just give us a little bit of balance in our state. So one, we can stop the bleeding, literally and figuratively. So we can have a little bit of break from Democrats pushing through all these insane ideas and policies that are just destroying public safety in our state, but also that we can have a course correct on some of these issues. And, you know, one of the indicators to me that has shown the lawless environment that has been created in our state are stolen vehicles. Because when you see, and this is the latest figure, this is the article from Cairo 7, 31,011 cars reported stolen in Washington this year. 31,000, that's 71 car thefts a day on average. 71 car thefts a day on average. That's crazy. There was 1,400 of those in King County in just the month of September. 1,400 in King County in 1 month. And 700 in Pierce County in 1 month. And a lot of them are Kia and Hyundais, because we know that little TikTokers put out videos saying, hey, these are really easy cars to steal. And then you look at our genius politicians and their response to stuff like this. They totally are not willing to take any culpability for how they've made this an easier environment for potential car thieves by limiting the ability of police to pursue suspects, for instance. And then with Bob Ferguson, what was his genius response to this? We need to go after Kia and Hyundai
right.
for making their cars so easy to steal. It's like, you're punishing Kia and Hyundai? Come on. I mean, there should be fixes for this, obviously, but you know, you punish the criminals, which are often young men. You don't, is that not politically popular for you to say, hey, throw the book at criminals who are ruining people's lives? And I go back to the people most impacted by this, the people most hurt by if they get their car stolen, are poor and working class people who have no safety net whatsoever, no financial safety net. And they might not even have good enough insurance to be able to get through this. And so it's really insane stuff. And again, I don't know how many more, is it going to be 100,000 cars for you to take it seriously for Democrats in Olympia to stop saying, oh, it's just somebody's car. It's not a life. It's just a car. It's really wild stuff. So it's insane to allow this to continue. Seattle voters have a good chance. In fact, you should have your ballots in hand, if not today, maybe tomorrow. Really good chance to change course in Seattle, which can be a good barometer for whether voters statewide are ready to change course as well. That being said, get those ballots in, by the way. Vote for sane people. Don't vote for the incumbents on the Seattle City Council, but get those ballots in. Vote for whoever you want, and please get your ballot in regardless, but also don't vote for the incumbents, okay? You know? Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We have a great episode of Sundays with Subscribers this week with Reuven Carlyle, again, a Democrat, but also a Jewish American who has some thoughts about anti-Semitism on the far right and the far left. It's a conversation really worth hearing. So if you'd like to watch that episode, you can sign up for just $5 a month. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. So I'll see subscribers on Sunday. I'll see the rest of you at noon on Monday.